to Making Therapy Better, the podcast that brings together some of the top minds in psychotherapy and related fields to talk about how we can achieve better mental health care for everyone. Making Therapy Better is hosted by Professor Bruce Wampold, who has dedicated his career to understanding how therapy works and advocating evidence-based methods for improving outcomes. His guest today is Michael Garrett, MD. Michael is Professor Emeritus of Clinical Psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, and previously served as Medical Director of the Department of Psychiatry at North Central Bronx Hospital and Deputy Director of Psychiatry at Bellevue Hospital Medical Center in Manhattan. He's the author of Psychotherapy for Psychosis, Integrating Cognitive Behavioral and Psychodynamic Treatment, which won second place in the American Journal of Nursing Book of the Year Award, Psychiatric and Mental Health Nursing category. His clinical and academic work has focused on better understanding the experience of psychosis and how it can be effectively treated with psychotherapy. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths has been helping in-person and virtual therapy practices thrive for over 20 years with their complete web-based EHR and practice management platform. CarePaths provides free tools to help therapists as well as clients benefit from the power of measurement-based care to improve therapy outcomes. Visit CarePaths.com to start your free trial, and clients should look for the free Making Therapy Better app, now available for iPhone and Android. And now, without further ado, episode 18 of Making Therapy Better, Can Psychosis Be Treated with Therapy? With Michael Garrett, MD.
So, Michael, it's great to have an hour to talk to you about psychotherapy with patients with psychotic disorders of various types. I read your book on psychotherapy for psychosis. Fascinating.
Thank you.
So
Thank you.
Let's start with, you're trained as a psychiatrist. You have background in psychoanalytic approaches. How did you get interested in and develop an expertise in psychotherapy for psychosis?
When I went to medical school, I wasn't sure what kind of doctor I wanted to be, but I became quickly fascinated with, and I remember a particular one-way screen exercise that one of the attending psychiatrists did with a psychotic man, and the question appeared to me, how did that person get from being somebody's son, daughter in a family, get to that condition here in the hospital? There must be a journey. There must be some way that transpired. So it's really been a central motivation of my career to try to understand that, to understand that transition, and to make psychotic experience approachable, in the sense that one can find analogies and see the path where from normal development one could get to that.
Mm-hmm.
On a more personal note, my father was in the military, I never lacked for anything while I was a kid, but it was kind of an austere home, and I didn't realize this until my later personal psychoanalysis, but I grew up feeling kind of an outsider to things, and I think that was a point of connection, empathy with psychotic patients, and I felt like I wanted to make a connection with those folks who were extreme outsiders, you know, in society. So I got interested in medical school, went to residency, started my personal analysis and analytic training when I was a psychiatric resident, and so here I am many years later. Delighted. That was one of the best choices I made. So,
interesting. I mean, you have a real curiosity as well as an empathic stance towards patients with psychosis. You know, many of us, myself included, had very little experience in our training with psychosis. I mean, I remember in my practicum experience of a patient with psychosis, actually the couple, it was a couple, but very little. So it's really interesting for me to read your material on psychosis, because you bring it, make it, I think, real through the descriptions, mm-hmm. not only of the interactions between you and the patient, but the narrative of the patient's life. Mm-hmm. Let's start here. You know, I've read in various publications and actually talked to others in this podcast series who make the claim, well, psychosis, particularly schizophrenia as it's defined, is a brain disease, high heritability, age onset in young adult, which would indicate some kind of physiological, neurological process going on. And the argument goes, well, differentiate psychosis or psychotic disorders from other disorders that have relatively low heritability, and age onset is across the lifespan rather than a particular time point, anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And the argument's made that these are kind of evolutionarily adaptive responses that have become dysfunctional for one reason or the other. So the argument goes on even further and say, well, the evolutionary adaptations gone wrong, dysfunctional, anxiety and depression, good candidates for psychotherapy, but not psychosis. So I know you have lots to say about this, the core of your work, but there is this idea, brain disease versus kind of a more adaptive behavioral issue, and really the appropriateness for psychotherapy.
It's a very important question, and you're quite right to say that in general psychiatric practice, the prevailing point of view is that what's called schizophrenia is a genetically determined brain disease. And there's no question that there is a relationship, and a complicated relationship, between genes and experience, environment. And if we look at the history of thinking about psychosis and in particular psychoanalytic perspectives, 100 years ago, Janet, Freud, Bleuler, were all thinking about trauma-related psychotic processes. And out of this came some very astute clinical writing and interventions, which kind of got lost over time as the German phenomenologists, Schneider was talking about first rank symptoms of schizophrenia. And then the idea that there is a brain disease, schizophrenia, became kind of reified. What's happened since, say, 1950, is that the so-called first-rank symptoms of schizophrenia have all been demonstrated by research to occur in a whole variety of other psychotic conditions. So they are not pathognomonic for a particular disorder. Not only that, but when you think about 1% of the population has clinically relevant psychotic disorder, and all the sophisticated machinery that we have now, biological machinery, in 70 years of looking for a single pathognomonic biological marker of schizophrenia, none has ever been found. Mm-hmm. And this is astonishing. This should astonish people. How could it be? There's an illness this devastating, and there's no trace, there's no marker. There's a simple answer to that. The trace is complicated. It's in the network of memories, associations, and experiences, which is what psychotherapy gets at. So a couple of other historical things, and then I'll tell you my opinion about all of this for what it's worth. With the advent of chlorpromazine in the 1950s, there were dramatic responses to acute symptoms. And there was a lot of excitement, you know, that finally, you know, there was a therapeutic agent that was really going to make a difference. And out of that came the so-called dopamine hypothesis, that acute symptoms result from excess dopamine. And there's some truth to that, that excess dopamine can cause acute symptoms, and that blocking dopamine can ameliorate those symptoms. But this then became a kind of whole dominant idea about what this disorder is, and the importance of trauma, the importance of life experience got lost in that. And out of that came the treatment of psychotic patients as diagnostic objects rather than as complicated subjects that had a certain condition. So as a diagnostic object, you go through your DSM criteria, you're trying to decide, does the person have this, 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 you're checking off present or absent items. And the subjective person, who has this condition, has a complicated life history, which if you listen for it, you'll hear it. You'll hear it in the symptoms, you'll hear it in the form and content of psychotic symptoms. So in the last 20 years, research has confirmed what clinicians have always known, which is that trauma is very important in the etiology of psychotic conditions. And for example, meta-analyses of a variety of studies now, the overall average figure in a study by Varies is 2.78 is the increased risk factor for psychosis in general for adverse childhood events. In the general population, depending on how you study it, about 15% of people report childhood abuse. In populations that have psychotic conditions, the number is typically closer to 50%. And in some studies, it's as high as 90%. Mm-hmm. So the incidence of childhood trauma is much higher in the psychotic population than it is in the general population. It also has been shown to have dose effects, which doesn't prove causality, but it's a strong indicator of causality. So in studies that look for one or two traumas, you get a dose effect that's in the 2.5 range. But if you have five or more traumas, it can rise up to the tenfold range. And for certain conditions, such as if a person has been raped, has phenomenological symptoms of PTSD, they have an 18-fold risk factor for delusions. So there's clearly a relationship between childhood trauma and psychosis. And I got to give you a chance.
Yeah, but the trauma you're talking about is sexual trauma, rape, or some kind of familial trauma. Is that right? I mean, we're not talking about automobile accidents, for instance.
No, not generally, but that's a very important question. What is trauma? Yeah. And the studies that I'm talking about have defined trauma primarily in terms of standardized checklists. So witnessing violence in the family, being an object of violence, bullying, emotional neglect, these things. So these are the things that are firmly correlated with an increased risk of psychosis. But as a clinician, you know, I know that trauma can be symbolic. Mm-hmm. It's not obvious. Here's an example. I consulted some months ago, a 16-year-old who, no family history of psychosis, but he was a shy, sensitive boy. And he had his first psychotic episode after his laptop was stolen. So stolen laptop doesn't appear on any trauma list anywhere. But for this boy, it was the end of the world because he was having trouble making the step of joining his peers, establishing some credibility for himself, having friends. And he had recorded some music and made some music that he kept on his laptop. And the laptop was stolen at a school party. And for him, it was devastating. How could his peers that he wanted to join steal, the thing that was most precious to him? So with the rug pulled out from under him, he didn't have a plan B. He didn't have a next step. So the loss of the laptop for him was traumatic, built upon a previous history of sensitivity, difficulty making friends. So in psychoanalytic terms, we speak of cumulative trauma. There's a layering of developmental weaknesses so that finally you get the straw that broke the camel's back and it seems like just a little puff of wind, but no, it's built upon a previous legacy. So you can't see the trauma so easily unless you really look for it as a clinician. You investigate it. The checklist is not enough. Can give you endless examples. Here's another one. We had an 18-year-old admitted to the hospital who claimed to be the sun king. So, okay, lots of dopamine firing off there, the sun king. That's a heavy claim. So, but here's the backstory, which emerged during the hospitalization. If you assume that there might be a psychological, you know, background to it, and indeed there was, when this young man was 16, his parents divorced, and they were, the parents hated each other, and they were using him as a kind of ploy between the two of them. And the father said, I'll give you a motorcycle when you're 18 if you come and live with me. So the boy chose to live with his father, which alienated his mother. And you can anticipate the story. His 18th birthday came, and did he get the motorcycle? No. His father actually was fairly ignoring of him, didn't fulfill the legacy. So he went back to his mother, hat in hand, and saying, you know, can I come back? You know, and the mother says, no, you chose. You know, you chose. But they talked. They talked at the door. She wouldn't let him in. And then she said in passing, you know, your father's a terrible person, you know, really a vile man. And nothing would please me more than to read in the newspaper in the morning that he had been murdered. And so there it is. That's the trauma. That doesn't appear on any checklist anywhere. This boy understood that the ticket back into his mother's good graces in the mother's eye was that he murdered his father. And he couldn't live in that world. He couldn't live in that reality. So overnight, literally overnight, he became the sun king. So you have to look for the trauma. Now, all kids who experience ugly divorces with their parents, they don't all become psychotic. Yeah. And all people who are sexually abused, they don't become psychotic. That's where I think the biology comes in. Because now we're in the realm of opinion on my just talking here. I think that the common etiology for essentially most human suffering is bad things happening to you. It's as simple as that. Bad stuff happens to you, and then it's filtered through your individual history and biology. So people who have DID, dissociative identity disorder, in relationship to trauma, there's experimental evidence that those people may have a heightened ability to self-hypnotize. This can be demonstrated, scientifically. So those folks, in the face of bad things happening to them, they may dissociate and form these separate personalities. And that's the way the mind fractures. for people who become psychotic, I think that there's a biological predisposition to the mind fracturing in a different way. And in psychoanalytic terms, we speak of the ego boundary, the division between what's inside and what's outside. And there's a split along the ego boundary where bad elements are projected outside the self. But there has to be a maybe in some people a biological predisposition to the fracture line going in that way. So the way I think of it, it's not the fracture line doesn't cause the psychosis. What causes the psychosis is the hammer of the trauma. But then the mind splits along a particular direction based on their biology.
Well, we see this in many disorders of vulnerability and events. The social context creates the disorder. So we have this vulnerability, biological, maybe it's the dopamine system, but whatever it is, clearly the trauma is significant. And you're saying it's not just a single traumatic event. It's a continued enactment of these dynamics. That, I mean, the divorce is a single event, but clearly that relationship of his parents and the manipulations and aspersions.
Right.
We're there from the beginning for this child.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't help but think that when I was trained, schizophrenia was talked about as this, at least from the systems people at the Mental Research Institute of Palo Alto, where I went and did some training, the schizophrenogenic mother. And so the blame was placed. Now, clearly, the way they talked about it has been disproven. But this idea that the familial environment and particularly adverse events are so important in the development of psychosis.
Yes, and there is some, there's a, I think, an important study by a, I think, Finnish researcher, Tienari, 2004. And he looked at 300 subjects where kids were adopted away. And something that he studied that other adoption studies didn't look at was family environment. And so there was loading of schizophrenic genes in that population. And what he found was that if the family environments were judged by independent instruments to be good homes, good family environments, the incidence of psychotic disorder was a little bit higher than in the general population. It's about 1.5%. So the genes were nudging things a little bit. But in families that were judged to be disordered, the incidence was 8 to 9 times higher.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the environment is releasing the gene, but the gene itself is not a sufficient condition for the expression of the disorder.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's get into the treatment because we've talked about the background and the etiology of psychosis. And then I want to come back to the issue of family in a slightly different way. But you talk about stability versus recovery. So before we actually get into the essentials of your treatment, there's some of these issues I think need to be clarified. So what do you mean by stability versus recovery in the treatment of psychosis?
I think a usual ambition in most busy inpatient services and outpatient clinics, and obvious to say, but the majority of people who suffer from chronic psychotic conditions are treated in public facilities, not privately. What well-meaning, hardworking team, staff try to do is to provide the patient with as much community tenure as possible. So the patient has an acute relapse, they're admitted, they're typically restarted on medication, or the medication's changed, and then when they're no longer a danger to self or others, they're discharged either home or to some residential facility. So stability means not exactly, but close to being able to live outside the hospital, having a life there. But it doesn't mean, stability doesn't mean regaining your pre-morbid level of functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another opinion. I think it's not intended this way, but one of the most insidious things about a purely biological model is that when patients don't get better, the clinicians speak of treatment-resistant schizophrenia as though we're waiting for the biological messiah to come and, you know, give the right treatment so the patient can get better. And what we should be thinking of is inadequate treatment for schizophrenia, not to blame the patient, but to be thinking, and not to blame ourselves, but just to say, we don't have it right yet. We don't know what to do about this condition. And what's grossly missing, I think, is what I call in my book, ambitious psychotherapy, which doesn't mean that everybody is going to get their pre-morbid level. But it means that you're not going to throw in the towel on people. You're not going to say, you know, it's got a chronic brain disease. You know, what can I do? And the fact that they're not better doesn't surprise me. And when I give talks sometimes, from time to time, I present a couple of cases of people who were completely recovered with psychotherapy. One woman who was ill for 20 years, she believed she had a horrible smell and heard voices and the people in the neighborhood were tracking her, and she got better. She got better with psychotherapy. So there's sometimes a question, oh, well, Dr. Garrett, you know, yes, the patient got better, but that just proves you had the wrong diagnosis.
What
a tautology. What an uninformed...
What you talk about is both encouraging and discouraging at the same time. It's discouraging because I think you said this, but most patients with schizophrenia are treated in this idea of stability. Let's just keep them medicated sufficiently that they're not problematic to society or to themselves.
That's right.
The encouraging part is you're saying that with treatment, there's hope, and the hope is communicated to the patient that progress is possible.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen in every case, but that's true of any disorder, right? We're not 100% successful with chronic depression, for instance. But there's this communication. You know, I'm with Jerome Frank's daughter, revising Persuasion and Healing. And the talk about hopefulness as so therapeutic and nothing else to approach the patient with this idea that with hard work, there's the potential for hope.
Absolutely. That's so important. I've had several patients tell me, you know, as they've been making progress, it's quite moving. They say, you believed in me. Mm-hmm. You believed in me.
Yeah.
And when you think of the antithesis of that, that nobody believes in you, that it's kind of, what's the point?
Why is it with most disorders, it's fine to communicate that hopefulness, but somehow with schizophrenia, we shouldn't be telling patients that you have a brain disorder, there's not much hope, we'll stabilize you, and they're excluded from receiving a treatment in which there's hope. So
there's a lot of reasons for that. As you know, given your career, as psychotherapy has evolved, there have been refinements of technique for particular populations. So transference-focused psychotherapy, Kernberg's work, is based on a psychoanalytic understanding, but there are refinements of technique that are required to work effectively with those people. So what I hope my work and book is an effort to do is to say, here's a refinement of technique that I've found useful in working with some patients, which is the combination of CBT and the psychodynamic perspective. So we need a critical mass of clinicians who are interested in this kind of work, interested in the idea of refining techniques, and also sufficient funding, because and this could be done in a kind of triage fashion. So you can't predict 100% which patients would be good candidates for psychotherapy, but you can make a guess. So a young person who is frightened, is suffering, and is motivated to connect with a therapist, those people are generally good candidates for psychotherapy. A person who is grandiosely indifferent and doesn't care about paying the rent, those are harder patients to work with. So there's plenty of folks we could work with. And so you're absolutely right. I'm not trying to romanticize this, you know, just do a little psychotherapy and everything's going, no, we're in the early stages of refining techniques.
Well, reading through your book, I realize this is difficult work. I mean, this isn't treating motivated major depressive disorder patients who want to get over this episode. This is intensive and difficult work. Let's get into the treatment, because I don't want to, we could spend a lot of time with the context of this, but in your treatment is really an integration of cognitive behavioral therapy and psychodynamic or psychoanalytic conceptualization and treatment. And you've talked a little bit about the psychoanalytic part of this. But those seem like strange bedfellows right there. There's not much agreement between those two approaches, yet you integrate this into a treatment for psychosis. So explain just briefly about the two components and how this integration takes place.
The metaphor that, you know, came to guide me is the idea that cognitive behavioral techniques can be helpful in encouraging patients to think about the literal falsity of a delusional belief. A psychodynamic approach can be very helpful in helping people understand the figurative truth of a delusional construction. And the a way to ground this in psychoanalytic theory, there are other ways to talk about it, is that Freud, as you know, talked about primary process and secondary process. So CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, emphasizes secondary process, logic, sequential reasoning, and primary process is the metaphorical, emotional matrix of connectedness of things that forms symbols. And that's what psychoanalysts interpret the unconscious meaning of that. So the CBT camp and the psychoanalysts, they don't go on the same elevator. You know, they don't talk to each other. But that's just a guild thing. That's not because the world is divided that way.
Okay.
Mental health is some kind of balance or combination between primary process, emotional thinking, and secondary process. And if you have a friend, if you meet somebody who has no metaphorical primary process going, they're probably going to be a boring person, you know?
Yeah.
And so both are naturally part of the way people think and the way they think about their experience. So I made a point in the book of saying, I didn't invent a new therapy. I don't have a new acronym or a name, but just fitting two things together in a way that makes sense to me. So what the technique does is you use CBT techniques first to raise doubts in the patient's mind about whether their explanation is inadequate. Very brief example, worked with a man who thought he was going to be arrested every day, that he was under surveillance, and this had gone on for eight years. So part of the CBT work was, you know, I've heard of the government following people who are high, you know, security risk, you know, for the nation, but that doesn't seem to fit you. You know, why would the government be that interested in you? That doesn't immediately turn the delusion, but you're adding doubts to, and then finally you get to a point where you say, well, you know, we've looked at a couple of questions that have come up about this. I wonder if there could be another explanation for why you're thinking this. And then I often invite patients, I have an idea. Would you be interested in my idea?
Mm-hmm.
And if I formed an alliance, I say, yes, I would be interested in your idea. And then I say, this has the ring of something that happened to you in your childhood, you know, where your mother was beating you. And I wouldn't go as directly to this, but your mother was physically abusing you and you couldn't figure out why. So you're kind of being arrested for no reason, you know, kid. So that's the rhythm of the therapy. The first thing that comes is engagement before you do the CBT or anything. You form a relationship with the patient. So, yeah.
And that comes from both the empathic stance, but the curiosity about the narrative. What is this? And what is this person's life? And how how does the psychotic symptoms fit into that narrative?
Exactly.
I like the story of, I mean, the reality testing in CBT. You actually took a patient and walked outside the consulting room with the patient to test this perception of,
right,
I forget exactly what the psychotic symptom was, but
I've made a couple of those trips.
Yeah, very much a CBT idea. So this idea of figurative versus literal truth, that the literal truth is the government spying on me, but what is the meaning of that particular manifestation?
Right.
Yeah, fascinating.
One of the things that I'm hoping to foster I should have realized this, you know, from the beginning, but it's not realistic to imagine training all psychiatrists to be psychotherapists for psychosis. It's just not practical. Not everyone's going to want to do it. Not anybody will have the listening ear for it. But something that I think that can be and should be taught to all psychiatrists is a listening attitude, a listening to the psychotic symptom to try to get a sense of what the meaning of this might be. And it takes a while to train oneself as a therapist. How long does it take to have the resolve to listen in a certain way? A minute. You can do it very quickly. And okay, I didn't understand everything, but I'm listening. There's a theme here of betrayal, you know, and I wonder, like that, you know, where just the listening attitude, you know, toward the patient, and patients feel this. Oh, doc, you're not treating me as a diagnostic object. You're actually interested in me. You're interested in my life.
Yeah. And
just that's therapeutic.
Mm-hmm. But it's more than just listening. It's a real curiosity with this idea that this is going to lead to something that's potentially helpful
yes.
to
yes.
you. So we want to believe yes, my therapist is interested in me, but also thinks that this is important to figure out to get better.
Yes.
Yeah. So this raises an important issue about endorsing the psychotic symptoms. So patient comes in, presents the symptoms. It's this idea that they're important to listen to, even if they're not literally true. And so you had a quote. I just want to read it because it just summarized for me so much about what you were talking about and how to think about this issue. You write, "Well, the patient's nervous system, with its connectivity and synaptic structure, altered by genetics and adverse life experiences, and the patient's psychology, with its pantheon of frightening internal objects, is serving up a version of reality that is every bit as compelling to the patient as the therapist's version is compelling to the therapist." Really says so much in that sentence about how to think about this patient and what the therapeutic stance is. So you want to elaborate a bit on that? That's a lot in that sentence to unpack.
Sure. A practical realization of this is that most clinicians who have, you know, been working with psychotic patients, they know that if you imply to the patient, even indirectly, that you're telling the patient that they're imagining what they're telling you, you've lost the patient. There has to be a third space that you're engaging the patient. And a way to practically find this out is I once asked a man, "So it's very clear to me that you're not imagining this. Do you know what it's like to imagine something?" And he said, "Sure, I do. Everybody knows what it's like to imagine something. If I imagine I'm going to the moon, I'm imagining that."
Yeah.
"And no, and this table, it's rock solid. But no, doc, this thing I'm telling you about, I'm not imagining it. And I know what it is to imagine something. This is something else." So that's the third space where there, as analysts say, there's a psychic reality. That's very powerful. You have to enter into the metaphor, enter into the story. And there are ways to do this without colluding with the patient, which I think is what many psychiatrists are afraid of, that if you talk about the delusion, you're actually reinforcing it. Quite the opposite is the effect. But you have to have some idea of what to talk about and what you're doing.
So the choices, the traditional choices, either collude that this is possible, you are being followed by the FBI, or you argue with the patient. How could you ever think that? That's just
right.
Illogical.
Right.
So that's the third space you're talking about.
Yeah, and some patients are so frightened of you that you immediately in the transference become a persecutor. They don't want to extend the conversation, and they insist that you vote immediately. Do you believe me or not? And the slightest bit of hesitation, they're out of there. I've literally had people get up and walk out and slam the door. But that's not most people. Most people are so lonely. They're so hungry to have a conversation with somebody. Nobody listens to them. Nobody takes them seriously in this way. So you want to keep the conversation going. So, "Doc, you think I'm making this up? James, we just met. You know, you're a complicated guy. What, you want me to jump in? I don't have an opinion about this yet. I'm still trying to get to your... What happened to you? Now, I got a question for you. This experience that you're having with the neighbors, was that always that way in your neighborhood?" Mm-hmm. "Oh, I see. It wasn't. There was a beginning to this. How old were you?" The idea is to keep the conversation going, enrich the conversation, invite the patient to be engaged in that conversation while you're trying to figure out when did it start and what's the meaning of it. And most people Well, another question I get at presentations sometimes is, well, yeah, you know, this might be very well and good, you know, to help some of the higher functioning psychotic patients. But, you know, what about the people who have profound thought disorder, you know, and they don't have any solid, you know, single delusion? So, I mean, the answer to that is, I don't know. We don't have the techniques to work with those folks, but there are plenty of clinics who can benefit from psychotherapy. So you triage and you focus on those people.
And well, to be sure, this is time consuming. This is This is not a 15-minute psychiatric consult.
No. Yeah. Even residents still in training, a second-year psychiatric resident who's seeing a patient, you know, in the clinic that they know, not a new intake, but a patient that they've seen before. I ask residents this just to make the point. I ask them, how long does it take you when the patient walks in to make an assessment of whether they're doing okay or you better listen very carefully, and maybe you're going to end up having to take the person to the emergency room. So, you know, I asked them this, like a resident might say, you know, 5 minutes, you know, I have to listen 5 minutes. And I said, you're a bit slow that day. You know, most people know, you know, in a minute when the patient comes in, you can tell by their cadence, their tone of voice, their eye contact and so forth. And in effect, the interview is over at that point. It isn't entirely, but the ambition of the interview is over. Okay, they're okay. They're doing okay on the meds. Let's do the 15-minute med check. Yes, you have to have more time to have an ambition for that's more than that.
You know, clearly you're skeptical of medication treatment for these patients. But... you know, as you said, for management of the symptoms, it can be helpful. So how does medication augment or interfere with the treatment you're providing? And how do you manage that?
I'm not against medication. And I think that for many people, it can be life-saving. It can be the means by which a person can live in the community rather than, you know, living in the hospital. So medication can accomplish things that psychotherapy can't. What's required is to try to combine the medication and the psychotherapy for the best advantage of the patient. And there's enough research now to show what should be the general objective with medication. Nancy Andreasen, who's a very well-known biological psychiatrist, she and her group established in serial brain imaging studies the basic idea that the lower the dose of medicine for the shorter period of time, the less structural changes you induce in the brain with medications. And they say this is a dilemma, you know, for clinicians, because you're trying to control symptoms, but you want to do it, you know, in the most parsimonious fashion. So that's skillful pharmacology. And then psychotherapy can get at problems that the medication doesn't do. And I've written as many scripts in my day. I don't do it anymore because I'm semi-retired and I'm focusing, you know, more on the psychotherapy. I worked on inpatient services for many years. I've written as many scripts as anybody else. So I'm not against it. I think that and this is an opinion, that what the medicine does. When you ask patients, now that you're on the medication, how do you feel about your neighbors? And the patient will say, well, you know, I still think that they're out to get me, but it doesn't bother me that much anymore. You know, mm-hmm. that what the meds do is they ameliorate the affect that is the driver to the symptom. And then as the affect quiets down, the cognition doesn't entirely disappear, but it's not crippling, you know, to the patient. Mm-hmm. And that's where psychotherapy can come in. Why might you have had that idea about your neighbors, and what does that have to do with the kind of history, you know, you've had?
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about the issue of the context of the patient's life. I had some contact for a few years with Jaakko Saikkola in Finland.
Yes.
And he had a program where the first psychotic episode, he worked to keep that person integrated into the family and society. And he thought that, as you know, I mean, psychotic people often are estranged from their family, workplace. They're isolated to a large extent. So his idea of keeping the person integrated. So I want to talk to you general about this idea of social integration and its importance, because you discuss individual psychotherapy and you also talk about the context, and sometimes the family is the progenitor of conflict and stress and adversity. So anyway, that's a long-winded question to say, what about the social context?
Yeah, what about? It's a whole other discussion why the open dialogue approach has not taken off in the United States. And I think there are political and financial reasons for that, the fragmentation of inner city society and so forth, and the culture in Scandinavian countries. Where I have a good friend, a psychiatrist there, who, as a young psychiatrist, wanted to organize a system where, through the schools, they would get early alerts to kids that seemed to be having trouble. And he did it.
Yeah.
There was enough. This is the idea, the way this should work. And there was enough support from the government, you know, with the oil money and a socialized society. He thought what would be the best plan, and he implemented it. In the United States, that doesn't happen. You know, there's the agenda du jour, you know, and you have to put some of that language in your funding and to get something going. And society is much more fragmented.
Well, I mean, our system is set up to pay for individual treatment.
Yes.
And we ignore interventions at any other level.
Yes.
I mean, you know, reimbursement for group therapy is complicated. You see individual patients, you get reimbursed for that particular code.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I get why programs like Open Dialogue just are not going to be compatible with our system. But this idea of social integration interests me, because I think often much of the distress from various mental disorders, not only schizophrenia, is social isolation, ostracism, loneliness. I mean, we know loneliness is a tremendous risk factor for illness, not just mental illness, physical illness, and death. So where does that fit into the treatment of people with psychosis?
First, to speak about my own limitations, I have a little experience doing groups in the outpatient department, but my own psychoanalytic treatment, my own predisposition, it's a limitation. It's the way I tend to think about things. but I also look for opportunities to extend the individual treatment. So two quick examples. The man that I was mentioning who thought that he was going to be arrested, who had an abusive mother. At one point in the treatment, after he had realized he wasn't going to be arrested, he then was really struggling to face what had happened to him. And he came up with the idea that he wanted to write his mother a letter challenging her. I sort of was a kind of blank screen, you know, for him to try out the letter and this kind of stuff. And he never sent the letter, but he kept at this. And finally, he decided that he wanted to actually go and talk to his mother about what had happened to him when he was a kid. And I didn't think that this was necessarily going to go very well, but I encouraged him to do that if he felt strongly, because I had a sense he had to do it. He had to stand up to her. So we role played in the sessions, and I pretended to be the mother, and you know, he was talking, and he did. He went and talked to his mother, and it actually went much better than I had anticipated. And she said, "I'm sorry. You're right. It didn't. What happened to you? It shouldn't have happened to you." And he, the patient, ended up feeling compassion for his mother, who was illiterate. Who was a black woman in society who had struggled to find her place. So the individual therapy extended outward to that immediate family situation. And he could not have accomplished that without the individual therapy. A woman that I worked with, the one I mentioned, psychotic for 20 years, she's in the book also. She wanted her son to come to a session where I think basically she wanted his forgiveness for having been absent as a mother. And a very touching session. He didn't pull any punches. He said, "It was very hard. You know, you didn't come to my graduations, but I love you anyway. There's nothing to forgive." It was wonderful, wonderful. So the individual therapy extended. So I look for those opportunities. But I don't start with the family meeting, but somebody else who's more comfortable, you know, the family approach you know, could go a different route.
Yeah. It's complicated. I always wanted to ask Jaco, but these families are often the source of the distress. So you've got to be very, very careful about keeping somebody immersed in that pathological kind of system. But it's hopeful to see groups, I mean, you and the various programs around the world to help people with psychosis. And this idea that it's not just we're going to manage your symptoms, but we're going to work towards progress, some recovery, some greater functioning in society.
Right.
So we're coming to the end of the hour, and that's a good place to end, is on that hopeful note, because what you have talked about is not just taking this as a brain disorder that we're going to manage with meds or some kind of ameliorative therapy sessions. We're going to work towards greater functionality, greater happiness, greater life participation and satisfaction.
Right. Thank you for having an interest in talking about this.
So, well, it's fascinating. Again, you know, it wasn't my training. I haven't had much experience in this area. So I have to admit, I hadn't thought about it as deeply as I have since I had the idea to invite you. And reading your book's been a pleasure and created that hopefulness for me. And I think it's important for therapists, whether we're treating patients like this or not, to understand how psychotherapy can be effective in the lives of people with a variety of disorders.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Well, Michael, it's been a joy.
A pleasure also, yes. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Be well.
Thanks for listening. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths offers a complete behavioral health EHR and practice management software solution, including claims, billing, clinical notes and documents, scheduling, and teletherapy, all for one simple and affordable monthly price. CarePaths EHR is HIPAA compliant and ONC certified, and can also support electronic prescribing for an additional fee. With CarePaths Connect, clinicians can enroll their clients in automated measurement-based care and create a digital front door for their practice. If you're just starting your practice or are dissatisfied with your current EHR, go to carepaths.com to start your free trial today. If you're currently in therapy and want to know how to get the most out of your treatment, check out the free Making Therapy Better app and visit makingtherapybetter.com.